This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm head of programming, Connor Boyle. For this episode, we're learning more about the cultural and sociological picture in a nation never far from the geopolitical headlines on the world stage, Iran. Writer and historian Arash Azizi discusses his recent book, What Iranians Want. Joining him to talk about it is journalist, audio producer, and book critic Maithili Rao. This episode was recorded in early March 2024, prior to the most recent episode of conflict between Iran and Israel. Let's join Maithili now with more.
Our guest today is Arash Azizi. He's a historian and the author of The Shadow Commander, Soleimani, the U.S. and Iran's Global Ambitions. He's also a senior lecturer in political science at Clemson University and a fellow at the Center for Middle East and Global Order. He's written for The New York Times and The Washington Post and is a contributing writer at The Atlantic. Today, we'll be discussing his latest book, What Iranians Want, Women, Life, Freedom, which I reviewed for The Guardian in January. Hi, Arash.
Hello, Maithili. It's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
A pleasure. Arash, before we get into the discussion of the book, which is all about the 22 and 2023 uprisings in Iran, and there's a lot to talk about there, I wanted to ask you a little bit about growing up in Iran. You were born in Tehran in 1988, correct? And you spent the first 20 years of your life in Iran. What are some of your earliest political memories?
That's right. I was born in 1988, you know, in the last closing months of the Iran-Iraq war. When my mom was pregnant with me, she always says that she was in bomb shelters when Saddam Hussein was sort of attacking Iran. So it's almost a different era by now, I feel. The Iran that I grew up in was obviously under the thumb of the Islamic Republic as it is today. It sort of had that repressive measures. But I think my first real political memory is 1987. I was 9 years old when Mohammad Khatami was elected president. When I was 13, he was re-elected president. And this was a time Khatami was someone who was a reformist. You know, he was a cleric. He was from inside the regime. He was not a radical by any way, in any shape or form, but he was a reformist. And behind him was this massive force of millions of Iranians, mostly women and youth. I remember my family and almost everybody that you knew was really excited that Iran was going to see changes. It was going to democratize. It was a time where, you know, almost everybody read newspapers. I remember, you know, my grandmother would ask me, or I hear her talking about, you know, the difference between democratic systems in Switzerland and France and the United States and which one would be better for Iran. So it was really this kind of a strange period, perhaps in the late 90s, early 2000s, where Iranians really had an idea that they could, they could see democratization and very soon. And of course, that's sort of not what came to pass. But one more thing I'd say about growing up in Iran is that, so, you know, that was my younger years. But then, you know, in my teenage years, Ahmadinejad was elected president in 2005. You know, lots of history one can talk about. But I have, grown up under this repressive Islamic Republic, as I wrote about in my book, where even some basic things in life are repressed. It can be pretty terrible in many ways. But I have very fond memories of growing up still, of course. It was an incredibly cultured upbringing, I would say. People my age in high school and around me, we were always into novels and theaters and movies. I've lived in many countries since. I always say I don't think I've ever really seen something like that, sort of everybody as a certain age was always into this sort of cultural products. And of course, the sense that they were standing up against this regime that wanted to ban all of this culture things that we loved and sort of was enemy and freedom also gave a great sort of source of camaraderie to us already in our teenage years. So I have very fond memories of growing up in Iran.
It's really interesting because one thing that does come across in your book and that I admired about it is this sort of sense of like political imagination being a really live thing and a collective thing. And obviously you're a historian. There's a lot of history you could have retold and kind of maybe 1979 on in particular, but you made a choice in the book to really focus on, as you put it, giving readers a window into the aspirations of Iranians, risking everything for change now. Why did it feel important to take an approach that like emphasized the contemporary in that way?
Yeah, you know, I think the reason is that, you know, in the last few years, during 2022 and 23 movement, the movement known as Women, Life, Freedom, but also before that in the past few years, everyone around the world, they hear a lot of, you know, they hear a lot of news about Iranians rising up against the government. They all know there's a terrible government, there's a repressive regime, Iranians rise up against it. But I think it's sort of a flattening occurs, is that, so you see people rising up, you know these are the bad guys, you know in some ways in what ways they're the bad guys. If you know a little bit more, you know that women are forced to wear the hijab, so they don't want to wear it and they're fighting against it. But I think what sometimes goes missing is this very sort of rich tapestry of all the different kind of movements that Iranians are involved in. And the... You know, I started writing the book in early last year, like in January 2023. And my intention was to really give voice to this, you know, I said what Iranians want, to these demands of Iranians that were coming out of the movement. That it wasn't just about, you know, it wasn't just about getting rid of a dictator. It wasn't just about changing one ruler for the other. It certainly wasn't just about, you know, it really wasn't just about, oh, we don't want religious leaders. Is that, no, actually, what do we want? You know, we want a better environment. We want to sort of take back our country. We want trade unions, want workers to have better rights. We want a sort of thorough democratization of society. These were really demands that were coming out of the movement, you know, and they had really been a subject my entire life. You know, we started talking about, you know, me growing up, but then that's really the story of my generation in many ways. We've lived through many defeats. And we've been sort of voicing the same demands for a very long time. So I wanted to, you know, as you say, focus on the contemporary to give a view to the to readers as to what is it the Iranians want, but also just a little bit of a historical background to know that, okay, in the last 20 years, Iranians have time and time again wanted, you know, have been fighting for this stuff and that they will continue to fight for them.
Oh, let's get into the book. It starts in September of 2022, and that's when Mahsa Amini, who was 21 at the time, was detained by the Iranian police's Moral Security Division, and she was eventually beaten to death. Her death set off a wave of protests. Do you remember when you first heard about her, what you were doing, when you kind of saw the first notification, the first, you know, probably the way many of us get news now, a tweet,
yeah,
a post on X, or maybe a message from a friend, whatever it was. What was your sort of initial realization of, oh, this is a story to watch?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question because I think a lot of us might, you know, obviously when it was happening first, we didn't know that it will spiral and become this grand movement. The Islamic Republic does so much cruelty on a daily basis that, you know, you don't know which one of them will spark a movement. But I remember a picture of her that I think I saw that was very, very shocking. A picture of her in a hospital bed, I think shortly before before dying. And by the time the picture was circulating, I mean there was already news that she's in a coma, and then the news that she had unfortunately died. And you know, I remember this picture being everywhere on Instagram. You know, on social media, and people just the sort of raw rage that overtook many of us. And I'll tell you why this raw rage, because you know, so Mahsa, as the pictures of her later showed, you know, she was from Kurdistan in western Iran. She was visiting Tehran for her sort of birthday weekend. She was doing some shopping where these vans that stand out and outside metro stations all over Tehran, take her in, beat her up, and then sort of she dies from her injuries later. And the reason this was so enraging is that it's this feeling that this could be really, you know, it wasn't actually immediately not even about hijab. It was about a group of men who are answerable and accountable to no one, and they could do this to any of us. You know, because imagine, you know, when I say any of us, you know, okay, so let's say some families are more religious, you know, my own grandmother or others, you know, they wear very seriously their hijab and it's their choice, right? But they have the rest of us, right? They all know someone. They know it could be their sister, their cousin, their granddaughter, you know, that could have been killed like this. So it was this realization that this group of men, the Islamic Republic, who are a minority, who represent a minority and are accountable to no one, can do whatever they want with us, with the rest of us. And in terms of this them and us sense, I think really makes a lot of us angry and gave rise to the grand movement that that came.
You've talked about it a little already, but I think it's probably worth you spelling out the demands of the movement for people who haven't followed as closely. It was, like you said, a range of things. And in your book, you write about it being also a demand just for a normal life. But if you were to kind of zero in on the specific demands of the movement, how would you explain them?
Mm-hmm. This is an excellent question. Let me put it this way. So obviously the first demand was a fight against this compulsory hijab. The fact that Iran is the only country in the world where women are forced to cover their head, no matter who they are, no matter how young or old, no matter whether they're Muslims or not, no matter whether they're citizens or foreigners, no matter whether they're sitting in their own car or they are in public places, everywhere they're supposed to cover their hair. And not just their hair, basically. They need to cover all their bodies except their face and their hands. You know, so it's more than anything, you know, it's sort of an obscene regime of suppression, right? Because in order to do this, right, you need police forces all over the country that will try to enforce this.
And the enforcement's quite erratic as well, right?
Yeah, like, it can be erratic.
You know, it's not like there's an accepted, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is there's not like a clear cutoff at which you have violated the dress code or not. It's sort of like on a given day, who decides and based on what?
Yeah, I mean, you know, technically there is that, as I said, the fullest one is that, you know, only your face and your hands can be out, right? But yeah, in effect, there's been a fight between people, and I should say, there's been a fight between women and the authorities. I should say that as I speak now, the most important achievement of this movement is that as I speak to you now, millions of women, probably I can even say tens of millions of women, are sort of engaging in this civil disobedience by disobeying these laws every day. If you just now call someone in Iran and look at an average restaurant in Tehran, in many other cities even, you'll see tons of women, perhaps a majority of women, not wearing their hijab. And they pay a very heavy price for that, by the way, right now. It's a sort of a cat and mouse fight, as I said, between the government and the woman. Your car can be towed. A restaurant that tons of restaurants or cafes that have served women like this have been closed down, and sort of many other issues. Someone on a state TV recently even claimed that they're going to use cameras to not only automatically find women. So if you're driving your car and you your hair is out, you can see money taken out of your bank account immediately. You know, and there is sort of no legal basis to what he said, but already they've, you know, I have a friend who they just towed their car for 2 weeks. So yes, it's always been a side of a struggle, and it changed a lot throughout my lifetime, right? From when I was a kid, how women could dress outside, to when I was a teenager, it drastically, very drastically changed. But you know, So the fight has been going on now. So the movement against this compulsory hijab was always there. But of course, it was not just the movement against compulsory hijab, because as I said, the root of it was this idea that this group of authoritarian, certainly minority, corrupt people who bring nothing to Iranian society and take everything from it, have to be confronted. And this came on the back of previous movements in 2017, in 2019, before that in 2009. So really came you know, at the end of a long streak of struggles against the regime. And sometimes people struggled and protested by a street protest. Sometimes they tried voting when it was possible to vote for, you know, a reformist or one candidate against the other. But they've always fought against the status quo basically throughout my entire life. Now, what were their demands? You know, one of the best ways to answer this is, early on, a trend started on social media using a hashtag called Baraye, which means for the sake of or for. And just random people started basically talking about their dreams using this hashtag. You know, you can compare it to sort of imagine of John Lennon. They started saying, you know, imagine an Iran in which our environment was taken better care of, in which our lakes wouldn't be drying up because of sort of corruption and because of lack of care, in which people could dress up however they wanted, in which you could buy whatever book or music that you wanted. You could listen to or read whatever you wanted. And they, you know, this led into thousands of tweets of people really imagining this new Iran. And Shervin Hajipour, a singer, young singer who is in prison now as we speak, came up with a song that later on won the Grammy, of course, sort of came up with a ballad, if you will, a song, a sort of anthem for the movement, which string through, you know, brought together some of this sort of tweets to mention some of these demands. And these demands are for, as I said, they're for gender justice, they're for environmental justice, they're for a better economic situation. But more than anything, really, they are for democracy and democratization. But for us, it's not just a slogan or empty word. It's about taking back our country, basically. It's the idea that Iranians, and that's why this is also a very national movement. That's where democracy meets the sort of national part of this movement. It's been hard to sort of understand sometimes for even for us Iranians ourselves how to navigate this. But I think it's certainly a sort of a national renaissance or rejuvenation movement, because it's an idea that, you know, our country can be better than this. You know, it can provide a better life for its citizens. And normal life, you mentioned normal life. It became a slogan for a normal life. It's one of those tweets also, but it has also been discussed in the past few years. And it's a very striking slogan when you think about it, because what do we mean by a normal life? Well, just think of how the very basic ways in which life is abnormal in Iran. In a way that it's not like even in the many repressive dictatorships. After all, the Middle East is full of dictatorships, you know. But in none of them, these sort of random restrictions on life are there, especially for women who form half of the society. You know, it's not just a mandatory hijab. Think about things like, you know, getting on a motorcycle is banned for women. Smoking publicly in many places are banned for women. Women need the permission of their husbands or their fathers to travel. I remember my mom, you know, a very successful filmmaker in Iran. She would travel to a city to shoot, and she couldn't stay in a hotel room without having sort of a permit from my father, let alone leaving the country. Which are sort of daily humiliations that are imposed on Iranian women. And for the rest of us, you could be walking down with a girl in a street in Tehran as a man. And this could be your friend, this could be your cousin, this could be your sister, and you could get arrested. And then, you know, you'd have to explain what is your relationship to that woman. So all the ways in which life is abnormal in Iran, all the things that makes our government abnormal, the way it also spends our resources on sort of going on adventures around the world, all the things that makes it unique and abnormal are why Iranians are asking for a normal life. Frankly, it's the minimum of our demands is to have a life that is a little bit more normal, a little bit like, you know, other countries in the region and the world even, before we even get to democratization.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
You write in the book about the kind of groundwork of these protests, which I think is interesting because a lot of the news coverage doesn't necessarily get into that. Like you were saying, the unions, the sort of long history of activism and organizing that's in some ways a little less glamorous and a little slower building. But I think maybe before we talk about that, I want to ask also about the stuff that people do really see, which is the hashtags, which millions of people retweeted, and the kind of surge of stuff on the streets. How does the sort of online and street protest components work together? And are there sort of shortcomings of the sort of explosive energy of a protest fueled by online activity?
I think it's an excellent question and part of a global conversation. I think what we have to come to realize from the perspective of 2024 is that these illusions in online activism, this sort of hashtag-fueled explosions that are supposed to be sort of post-ideological.
Which was a big part of this movement too, right? Is it fair to say, right?
I mean, I think it's fair to say that it had a lot to do with how the movement sort of found a global audience. And sort of previous rounds of it. But I think it's also the case that, as I said, there were tons of other, there are tons of other protest movements that happened in Iran throughout this period. And as you mentioned, and I'll speak a little bit more about that as well, there were tons of this less glamorous work of these groups that had, civil society had been keeping up for a while. So it wasn't quite an online explosion only, right? It relied on, sort of pent up anger in society, and people who were not on the internet at all as well would have joined it. But there is definitely a similarity to other movements around the world in that there's this idea that people come out and they're on the streets, and if they somehow stay on the street long enough, magically they'll lead some political change, and magically also this will be the political change that somehow meets what the majority of the protesters want. I think the lessons of the 2010s is that this is not what you get. There's a couple of great new books on this, Vincent Bevins's book about what he calls a decade of mass protests in 2010. Not only it's not like this, but it's actually a pernicious illusion that you can sort of not do politics as usual in some ways and organize political parties, political platforms, fight over different demands, and somehow get things done by capturing public opinion or coming out in the streets alone and using hashtags and all that. So, I think this has hurt Iranians as well and their movements. I think and I hope that we can be disabused of these illusions enough. I think they had a big role in 2009 already. 2009 was one of the first revolutions where people sort of called the Twitter revolution.
There was I was going to ask you about that because I remember working on stories on that early in my career, and the sort of early sense of astonishment and possibility. And we all had a different relationship with social media then too. And watching that unfold, it seemed like, oh, this is something really extraordinary and different. And I think maybe we were all a little bit unaware or naive about the shortcomings of social media. And also, yeah, I think definitely. The way it exposes people who are involved in activism too, and can sort of leave people very vulnerable as well, right?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And you know, 2009 was Iran. Of course, then we had the Arab Spring in 2011, yeah, which was spectacular and led to all these places. And unfortunately, it fit the kind of exact biases that are dominant in the West and through the West, and, you know, Silicon Valley can travel the world. After all, wouldn't it be really nice if you had this way where this cool, supposedly, you know, this cool, I don't know, Twitter connected, whatever it's in the sort of imagination of the liberal middle class in these countries, could just change decades of repressive rule by coming together and a few people dying. And, you know, it would be great if it can happen. The problem is that, of course, it doesn't happen. The normal rules of politics don't get suspended because you have a shiny new toy. And sure, the best social media can do, it can get information to people very quickly and bring them out. But then what happens, right? You need organization and the... Unfortunately, you know, I'm very bitter about this, as you can tell, because I've also lived through this, right? I remember in January, February, March, April of 2011, discussing with different friends in Egypt, in Syria, in Tunisia, to say, no, you won't get the change you want by staying in the square. You know, you can't be the change you want to be in the world just because you have a cool, you know, tent in Tahrir Square in Cairo, where you have established egalitarianism or whatever. This will not lead to a change in a country of 80 million that, you know, you need to wash out for Muslim Brotherhood and army, which are organized forces. But unfortunately, it was a tough period, I think, to live through. And the same in Iran, 2009, you know, I was a sort of a young leftist in 2009, but to read, you know, op-ed after op-ed saying that, oh, the age of revolutions is over, this movement doesn't have parties, doesn't have, it's horizontal, this worship of the fact that it's horizontalism. Oh, you, and you know, both left and the right did this. There's some sort of cruel irony of that, you know, sort of anarchism or sort of anti-Stalinism of the left sort of led to this promotion of horizontalism. And of course, on the right, as I said, sort of Silicon Valley tech optimism, they all met in this celebration of some sort of horizontalism. You know, so I think basically one of the issues in Iran, in the movements, have been these beliefs that if you're loud enough, and this obsession, can I just also say, this obsession with public opinion in the West, right? You know, this idea that if only enough people in America and Britain and Germany knew about the movement in Iran, surely this somehow translates to political change. No one has explained to me how, right? No one has said to me, why is it that people in New York caring a lot about the movement in Iran, will, you know, how is this going to lead to change, right? If they spell it out, does it do mean foreign intervention, which, you know, we neither want, nor do we think it sort of works in a straight way. So I think that there's a lot of illusions here. But, you know, the kind of grunt work that you mentioned is really, you know, the result of the fact that I mentioned very briefly in the beginning, you know, I was 9 years old when Khatami got elected. So what happened really was that Iran opened up a little. It opened up a little. The terribly repressive 80s and the 90s, in the late 90s and early 2000s, gave way to a situation that, okay, you could open a book club, you could open an association, you could write in newspapers, for the first time I remember, Marx and Lenin, you know, their books was published openly in Iran. That was happy for the leftists, but there were tons of also books by, you know, liberal theorists that were published. And you know, Richard Rorty, American philosopher, and just to give you a sense of that era, you know, famous liberal philosopher, when he came to Iran, I remember newspapers on the headlines would say, you know, Rorty's second day in Iran. So he was like a global celebrity in Iran. You know, it was sort of strange for him. He never expected to, you know, face that. My point is that it was a very...
There's a hunger for that kind of discussion and...
Exactly. There was a hunger... Yeah, and this led to tons of new, so trade unions, feminist groups, right, opening up here and there. And they did this grunt work, right? I think to this day, you know, I'm 36. I think I've organized in many different countries. I lived in many different countries. I think the most fascinating movement that I've ever seen was a movement called Campaign for 1 Million Signature, that I think I mentioned in the book. And this was a feminist campaign to get 1 million signature to change discriminatory laws against women in Iran. And, you know, the striking thing about it was how women went all over the country. I remember, you know, they were my friends going all over the country, you know, to villages, cities, talking to women and telling them, you know, these are our rights and these are our rights we should fight for, and getting their signature. And so, you know, they did this groundwork of organizing and building groups and coming, you know, going through what are the usual difficulties of a group, agreements, disagreements, when are we too radical, when are we not radical, you know, this sort of stuff that is, you know, that really builds political groups. And I think the, you know, if any young person reads this book or is interested in change, I think what we should remember is that there is no shortcut there. Like, building these groups is how, you know, it's how you can get to political change. Unfortunately, you know, not through sort of hashtags and even street protests, which on their own, a street demonstration is just a demonstration of your power. Unless you don't have theories of change and strategies for change, you're not going to get there. And I think that's the sort of a lesson that Iranians have learned very bitterly.
About some of those bitter lessons, the kind of human toll of just the 2022-2023 protests, if I have my numbers right, it's something like 22,000 people detained, more than 500 killed, really brutal treatments in prison, kind of harrowing accounts from people who are locked away. You finished the book last July, and kind of the conclusions of where the movement might go next were a bit open-ended. And I'm curious, from where you sit now, how your thinking on that has changed and sort of where you think this movement goes from here. There is that groundwork. There was that sort of mass interest within Iran, a little bit around the world, brutal crackdown. Kind of what happens next?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. You know, social struggles, civic struggles are optimistic by their nature. You know, you have these beautiful slogans like, you know, venceremos, you know, we will win, we will overcome. We are on the right side of history. You know, the arc of history bends toward justice. Unfortunately, the arc of history doesn't always bend toward justice, and we don't always win. And if you're honest, the reality is that the movement against the Islamic Republic and for democratization in Iran, from the perspective of March 2024, when you and I are speaking, doesn't have
clear pathway for
a great
forward.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not in a great shape. Not only doesn't have a clear pathway, but it's not in a great shape. Now, I'm generally an optimistic person, and I'll tell you what are the optimistic things. In the last year, it was sort of a moment of truth. We Iranians failed to put up a political opposition that could offer a real alternative to the Iranian regime. Disagreements between ourselves, majority of Iranians that are opposed, and sort of political representations of them were more than what they could bring them together. That's the reality, because because the reality is, if you want to bring together a diverse coalition to bring down the government, you know, you need to be able to put your differences aside for the purpose of uniting and bringing down the regime. And this is not an easy thing, especially because we live in sort of an age of individualist expression. Everyone wants to be themselves. Everyone wants to have a voice. Well, you know, it's kind of harder to do politics because, you know, if you want to join a political group, and if you want to, especially if you want to join a broad political coalition, you have to accept that there will be Muslims and non-Muslims. There will be people who are devout Muslims and those who are not. There will be those who have radically different ideas about Iranian history, about economy. There will be leftists, there will be right-wingers, right? And the idea is that, okay, you agree on some sort of democratic vision. This is the minimum of what we would need to bring down this government, and we were not able to get it last year. Now, the good news is, I think it was sort of a moment of truth. So I think it showed a lot of bad actors to everybody. I think it led to people realizing that, okay, maybe, hopefully, I am hoping, now we understand that horizontalism doesn't work. We understand that we need political organization, that political alternatives. And, you know, the struggle continues. What gives me hope is the fact that, as I said, this amazing energy and relentlessness of Iranians. I mean, just the thing that I told you about the civil disobedience of women not wearing their hijab. I mean, it's absolutely awe-inspiring to me. And it's not just not wearing their hijab. It's the kind of fights that they do every day. If you just sort of follow the news in Iran every day, I think a lot of Iranian men are always speaking about how they're in awe to sort of our Iranian women. But also other Iranian men as well, of how they keep, you know, the fact that they don't give up, it's kind of amazing, right? You would think that, okay, if they tow your car, maybe you'll just cover your hair. But, you know, my friend who they towed her car, she's not covering her hair now either. And she just keeps fighting the fight. Now, I do think there will be grand changes in Iran. I think the fact is that this regime is really ideologically bankrupt. I think it sort of suffers from not just a crisis of legitimacy, but a crisis of representation, but most importantly, a crisis of competence. It's just has run Iranian economy to the ground. Its foreign policy has put the country in danger of war. So I do believe that, you know, Ayatollah Khamenei is 84, soon turning 85 in about a month. And I think when his time is over, he's the only thing that's really holding the regime together. My prediction, as I just outlined in an article I published this week in the New York Times, is that the Iranian rulers will bring about some changes. Now, this will not be democratizing changes, but they'll probably get rid of mandatory hijab. They'll relax some policies. This will be all achievements of the movements like 2022 and those that fought before. They would not have been in vain. And they'll, you know, in order to sort of, the new rulers will have to, in order to calm things down and get a hold on Iran, will have to bring about these changes. But then, even then, our struggles will continue. Ever since at least 1905, where the constitutional revolution launched in Iran with a demand for rule of law and a parliament, we have fought for this universal values of democracy, of fairness in relation to law and all that. And that is a fight that will have to continue. And I have no doubt that it will continue. And I hope, as I said, that we can learn the lessons from the failures that we have, which has to start by us accepting that they were failures. And then there are lessons to be learned. And, we don't sort of keep doing the same thing again and again.
One last question for you about lessons. For people experiencing their own version of political frustration in the UK, where I'm sitting today, or in the US or elsewhere, do you think there are concrete lessons in activism that they can take from the Woman Life Freedom Movement? And I say that with the caveat that we've just talked about the ways in which the movement hasn't achieved everything it wants to yet.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think there really are lessons. There are always lessons in failure as well as in success, right? So let me talk about some of the lessons. First of all, I think it's the idea that you need organization, that we need to get over this sort of almost narcissistic obsession that we have with individual expressionism. Politics is not a realm of just individual expressionism, right? Yes, it's great to find yourself. It's great to have a way of wanting to express yourself. But perhaps we've gone too far following the 1960s and sort of this this rise of this kind of politics. Perhaps we've gone too far in that direction. That after all, politics needs to be a collective effort. That, you know, Arash and Vitaly will have many differences, but maybe we agree on something together and we need to come together to work for it. In the United States, for example, there is now a fight for reproductive rights, for the right to abortion that is being banned. There are people with stark differences on pretty much everything else. But I think, thankfully, they're learning that we need to come together to fight on this one issue that we agree about. And after all, that's how politics has always worked and will always work. So I think the idea that organization really matters, that there's no alternative to the groundwork of, meeting regularly, joining a group, accepting that you need to be a part of a group. There's no pride in just saying, you know, I'm an individual. I'm so different. I'm beyond all politics. I don't want to join any group. They're all the same. And this sort of brings me to the other issue. I mean, I already sort of talked about it, into coming together with different people. You know, the idea that we always feel that political choices are so limited, and, you know, we can, you know, we have good reasons to. After all, you know, I'm an old-time member of the Labour Party in Britain, and I sometimes struggle to find out what exactly, you know, different it is in its agenda today than some parts of the Conservatives. You know, the change is not always what people want to see, especially now, for example, when we see in relation to Israel's war on Gaza, and, you know, we'll see how different parties of center-right and center-left effectively have sort of similar lines. Although I think there are stark differences in the United States, obviously, between Biden and Trump on this issue. But I think it's important to realize that, yes, we have limited political choices, but that after all, politics is about working with other people. And in a country of millions of people, you know, you will always have to, you know, you'll always have to work with people who you disagree on with many other things. And sort of boycotting the process and not going through it, you know, certainly not voting or things like that will never bring you change. I think what Iranians have shown in their better moments, actually, is that they can be quite flexible in sort of trying different tactics to gain certain things. After all, President Khatami, that people voted for in 1997, did not stand for any of our demands. If anybody thinks, I don't know, Keir Starmer or Joe Biden doesn't represent for all that they want, try voting for people like Khatami or President Rouhani, as, you know, many of us did in 2017. But we understood that supporting one side against the other can open up the political space, and it did open up political space. All the trade unions, feminist groups, all the groups that I write about in the book would have been impossible had that opening had not been made. And in fact, perhaps some of the mistakes of these groups was that they went faster, you know, than this opportunity allowed, and very easy they would say, okay, now we're beyond this, you know, now we go to the next phase, without sort of patiently trying to look at the reality of politics and see what is it that they can do at you know, at every case. So as I said, after this decade of mass protests of 2010s, I hope everywhere we realize that change, political change, comes through patient work, and it comes through organization, and it comes through people coming together to unite on specific things, which means, you know, they'll, of course, they'll disagree on many things, but they'll agree on specific things. And this temptation of, you know, this temptation of wanting to end things with one big explosion on the streets, or thinking that if we get this obsession with awareness and, you know, with public opinion, you know, it comes, you know, it all boils down to sort of an obsession with media and with being seen, which is sort of a lot now in social media as well.
Which is different from getting collective buy-in, from all the other things, right?
Exactly. It's fundamentally different. And I think we need to, like, you know, they can have a role. Of course, media has always had a role. But I think, you know, perhaps we need to be humble a little bit and think about, you know, all the grand movements of the 20th century that brought all the great changes that did, you know, African National Congress brought down apartheid, you know, the Indian National Congress brought down British colonialism, and all the other achievements of the, you know, in the 20th century. And, you know, they had all these big, bad, old centralized political parties that, you know, we've all learned to dissect in so many ways, and they didn't have social media either. So perhaps we need to learn something about that from them, and use those lessons actually as we try to change our world for a better place. And the last thing I'd say in this regard, as an Iranian, is perhaps a bit of a cliche, but I would say, you know, the fact that you can organize without the police repression, you know, to get the changes that you want. You know, right-wingers usually like to use this to say, well, Iranians don't have freedom, we should appreciate our freedoms here. But they don't seem to be excited when people actually use these freedoms in any way. So obviously, that's not the sort of lessons I want to draw. But I want to say that Iran is an example of you know, when they give you political freedom, you can use it to achieve the changes that you want. The feminist groups in Iran used the even a slide opening that opened in late 90s to push for amazing changes in law and to organize and bring out people. So I think a lot of Iranians are sort of disappointed when they see, oh, okay, in a condition. And, you know, when I'm talking repression in Iran, you know, you have a group, let's say, and a writers group, Association of Iranian Writers. They arrest them every time they meet at someone's home, right? As soon as 20 Iranian writers gather together, they might be just to having tea. Someone will follow them and will break them down. So obviously, these are not the conditions that organizers face in around the world. So it would be important to use the freedoms that they have to organize for the changes that you want. And also remember that these democratic rights, rule of law, and all the rest of them are important, and they can be taken away. You shouldn't take them for granted. And they're not just, they're not just for the people of the law or whatever. Quite opposite. They're for the masses of the people who will use these freedoms to advance and fight for what they want.
It's a powerful note to end on. Thank you, Arash, for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much, Maitri. Thank you.
The book, again, is What Iranians Want, Women, Life, Freedom, and is available now from your local bookshop. I'm Maitri Rao. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Bella Soames. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.